Coming up on Star Stuff, rewriting the textbooks on the evolution of supermassive black holes, an ancient lake discovered on the red planet Mars, and icebergs on the oceans of Titan. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
A new study has found existing theories on the size relationship between a galaxy and its supermassive central black hole are wrong. The discovery by Dr. Nicholas Scott and Professor Alistair Graham from Melbourne Swinburne University found smaller galaxies have far smaller supermassive black holes at their centres than previously estimated. Central black holes, millions to billions of times larger than the Sun, reside at the core of most galaxies and are thought to be integral to galactic formation and evolution. The problem is, astronomers still don't fully understand this relationship. Scott and Graham combined data from observatories in Chile, Hawaii, and the Hubble Space Telescope to develop a new database listing the mass of 77 galaxies and their central supermassive black holes. Astronomers can determine the mass of a black hole by how fast stars are orbiting it. Existing theories provide a direct ratio between the mass of a galaxy and that of its central black hole. Now, while this ratio worked for larger galaxies, Scott says improved technology means scientists are now able to examine far smaller galaxies, and it turns out the existing theories don't hold up. Writing in the Astrophysical Journal, Scott and Graham found that for each 10-fold decrease in a galaxy's mass, there was a corresponding 100-fold decrease in the mass of its central black hole. They also found that smaller galaxies have far denser stellar populations near their centres than what larger galaxies do. According to Scott, this also means that supermassive black holes at the centre of smaller galaxies grow faster than their larger counterparts. You see, for the most part of it, black holes grow by merging with other black holes as galaxies collide. When large galaxies of similar mass merge, they double in size, and so too do their central black holes. But when smaller galaxies merge, their central black holes quadruple in size, because they're not only merging, they're also consuming the denser populations of stars nearby. Dr. Nicholas Scott.
If you take the existing sort of relationship for high-mass galaxies and followed it down to low-mass galaxies, that gave you a prediction for the size of the black hole you'd expect in those galaxies. And the black holes we found are actually quite a bit smaller, factors of 10 to even 100 smaller than predicted. What this means is that to get, for these low-mass galaxies with these unusually small black holes, eventually they're going to grow into these more massive galaxies with much more massive black holes. So that means these black holes must grow very much more quickly than the galaxies they live in, which is quite a surprising result that we hadn't really been anticipating.
Could that simply be because when you get two galaxies merging, there's a likelihood that their supermassive black holes will merge as well?
Really? That's what we think happens in the most massive galaxies. Essentially, you take two galaxies and you add the galaxy's mass together, and then you take the two black holes and they merge and you add the black hole mass together. So at that point, you expect if the galaxy mass doubles, you expect the black hole mass to double in those situations, which is this merging scenario. In the lower mass galaxies, you add the galaxies together, you double the galaxy mass, you end up increasing the black hole mass by factors of, say, of four instead. So the black holes are growing much more rapidly than we'd expect.
What are the implications of this?
The fact that there's a relationship between black hole mass and the mass or luminosity of the galaxy that lives in is in itself surprising. And theorists have suggested that the black hole plays a role in controlling the growth of the galaxy. And if the black holes are growing more rapidly, then we think that changes the relationship between the black hole and the galaxy and sort of changes how big we expect galaxies to get.
When you look at a black hole like the Sagittarius A star, mm-hmm. you can look at S2 and you see how fast that's going around.
Yep.
So you can work out the mass. How do you do
Absolutely.
That with other galaxies when you're trying to work out the mass of a black hole in a more distant galaxy?
It's a similar technique, but in more distant galaxies, we can't see individual stars.
Mm.
So we look at the average motions of a large number of stars. We see how rapidly they're moving on average closer to the black hole. And if you look at the very center, and there's a sharp increase in the it's the dispersion we're looking at, the kind of the random motion, the velocity of the random motion of the stars in the very center. If that sharply spikes, then that gives you a clue that there's a strong indication that there's a big black hole there. And then we can construct a model of the galaxy to really pin down how big that black hole has to be to give rise to the motions we're seeing.
Why do you think there's a difference between the mass-luminosity ratios between the larger galaxies and the smaller ones? Why are the smaller ones so much less luminous but growing quicker?
Well, in low-luminosity galaxies, they tend to have a lot more gas available to form stars, and this can also fall into the centre and sort of directly feed the black hole without this kind of merging with another galaxy or black hole thing. In the more massive galaxies, they tend to kind of they've used up most of their gas making stars already. So when they merge, the only way they can grow is from, well, is from directly adding the black holes together. There's no gas to kind of supplement the growth. And we think that's likely what's going on in these lower mass galaxies.
So when you say lower mass galaxies, are you referring to specifically dwarfs, or are you also including spirals compared to, say, ellipticals? I'm assuming ellipticals are all high mass galaxies.
Yeah, they are typically. There's a few odd ones, but the vast majority of them, yeah, at the high mass end. It's the dwarfs and spirals. So it's the Milky Way actually sits roughly on the divide between sort of a high mass and a low mass galaxy. So things less massive than the Milky Way, we think, are growing in this much more rapid way, whereas things roughly more massive than the Milky Way, you know, are just kind of merging and doing what we expect, really.
That's Dr. Nicola Scott from Melbourne Swinburne University. The findings may also solve another long-standing problem, that of missing intermediate mass black holes. You see, for decades, scientists have been searching for something between the size of a stellar mass black hole, formed when the larger stars die, and supermassive black holes, found at the centre of galaxies. According to Graham, if a central mass black hole in smaller galaxies have a lower mass than originally thought, they may well represent the intermediate mass black hole population which astronomers have been hunting for. Intermediate mass black holes are between 10,000 and several hundred thousand times the mass of the Sun. According to Graham, some of these black holes may be big enough to be seen directly by a new generation of extremely large telescopes now under construction.
To date, we've been able to measure the masses of black holes in very large galaxies. We've been able to do that because the black holes are also very large, and the larger something is, the easier it is to detect. Now, in smaller galaxies, we knew there was a black hole there from very high energy activity, the emission of X-rays. There's a disk of gas around these black holes, and the disk is very hot, and it gives off X-rays, and so we're able to actually infer the presence of the black hole from the emission of these high energy X-rays and also gamma rays. But we haven't been able to accurately measure the masses of these black holes. We know they're there, but we don't know how massive they are. The new research that we've done has better defined the relationship between the mass of the black hole and the galaxy within which it lives. Now, before, we thought there was a 0.2% mass ratio. 0.2% of the total galaxy mass was locked up in the black hole. We now know that wasn't correct. 10 or 15 years we've been assuming that, and we were wrong. But what we now know is that the mass ratio gets smaller in smaller galaxies, and so the black hole mass that we now infer in these smaller galaxies is actually in the range between that of a star and that of a million solar mass black hole. The types of black holes we've been able to observe to date have been 1 million times heavier than our Sun, and up to a billion times heavier than our Sun. Forever, there's been this gap between stellar mass black holes and what we call supermassive black holes, these million-plus solar mass black holes. So we've now bridged this gap. We've detected galaxies where we believe these intermediate mass black holes should exist. We know there are black holes there. We now have a better prediction for what the masses of those black holes are.
Now, those intermediate mass black holes you're referring to, they do the job of the supermassive black hole in a large galaxy.
Exactly.
Right.
Bigger galaxies have bigger black holes. The most massive galaxies have these supermassive black holes, a billion times heavier than our Sun. These smaller galaxies have these intermediate mass black holes, less than a million solar masses.
And when you talk about smaller galaxies, are you talking about things like the LMC or that sort of thing? Galaxies that size, dwarf galaxies?
Not quite that small.
Not quite that. Oh, bigger than that, right. Okay.
The Large Magellanic Cloud may actually, and probably doesn't have a black hole at its center.
It's just the stars themselves that are gravitationally bound.
That's right. That's actually a pure disk galaxy. There is no bulge component to that galaxy. And the relationship between the black hole and the galaxy is actually a relationship with the bulge of the galaxy.
So it's not an irregular galaxy. It's a disk galaxy that's been disrupted by its association, I take it, with the Milky Way.
That's right.
All right.
So that's why we sometimes talk about the bulge component, because there are disk galaxies out there which don't actually have a bulging component at the center, and they appear not to have massive black holes. Although that's still work in progress, so things may change in the future, but at the moment most diskless galaxies don't have massive black holes.
Professor Alistair Graham from Melbourne Swinburne University. NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter has provided evidence of what appears to be an ancient crater lake fed by groundwater on the red planet. The spectrometer data shows traces of carbonate and clay minerals, usually formed in the presence of water, at the bottom of a 2.2-kilometre deep crater. The new observations, reported in the journal Nature Geoscience, found McLaughlin Crater lacks large inflow channels, and so the lake which formed there was most likely fed by groundwater which left deposits of carbonates and clays. The 100-kilometre-wide crater sits at the low end of a regional slope several hundred kilometres long. And, as on Earth, scientists think groundwater-fed lakes would be expected to occur at such low elevations. The paper's lead author, Dr. Joseph Michalski, says the observations provide the best evidence yet for carbonate forming within the lake environment instead of being washed into the crater from outside.
In recent years, maybe in the last decade or so, study of life in extreme environments on Earth has revealed that we essentially cannot find a place on Earth where life doesn't exist. And in addition to that, up to half of the biomass of all of the living material on Earth, up to half of it might exist as very simple microbes in the deep subsurface. So that's very interesting. When you think about Mars, the surface environment is very oxidizing and cold and hyper-arid and really a violent place, not a place where even microbes are likely to thrive now, but the subsurface could be very different.
I know that orbital images from Mars have shown what look like water seeps dribbling out of the side of cliffs and crater walls. So, you know, there's a really good chance that some of the permafrost, at least on some occasions, melts.
Absolutely. We still really don't know entirely how much water exists on Mars, because we know how much, we can estimate how much water exists at ice in the poles. And we can make estimates of how much erosion has happened, so we know how much, you know, water may have been there. But the bottom line is that a lot of the water that would have ever been on Mars may have become sequestered into the subsurface as lenses of ice or as groundwater, even in the deep subsurface. Well, so this paper is a couple of things. We do have some new discoveries, and we also... One aspect of the paper is that it's a bit of a synthesis paper. And what we've done is we've looked at a lot of recent discoveries from people on this team, but also from a number of other researchers in the community. And there have been a number of papers recently that have shown that the minerals, the rocks that are exhumed from the subsurface of Mars, those things are very commonly altered. They contain alteration minerals. So by summarizing a number of those results, as well as results from people on this team, we are able to describe how alteration has occurred from water at depth. So that's one way that we synthesize new information. And just very briefly then, one of the ways where we have sort of a new discovery is that, you know, we can estimate that if water did exist in the subsurface, there may have been times when it breached the surface. As you described, maybe you have these events where briny fluids come out of the walls of craters or something like that. So in one of these craters called McLaughlin, we see evidence that there was once a lake there, and that lake was probably fed by groundwater that came out of the subsurface.
What are the minerals that have leached to the surface that give you that impression?
It's a number of things, Stuart. Some of the evidence is what we would call morphological, and some of it is mineralogical. For one thing, we looked in this crater to begin with because it's quite a deep basin. It's the kind of place where if you were going to have groundwater come out of the subsurface, where would it come from? Where would you normally find that? And that's in the deeper basin. So that was a good place to look. And then you look in there, and you have a number of things. We have channels on the wall of the crater, which terminate, like the channels are eroding the wall of the crater, but they all end at an elevation that is about 500 meters above the floor of the crater. So why would a number of channels all end at the same elevation, you might ask? And one reason for that would be if there was a lake level there. The channels stop eroding when they hit the surface of the lake. So there's obviously no lake there now, but that's one way to estimate that there was one there and how deep it might have been. Okay, so another thing. In the floor of the crater, we see a number of debris flows, and debris flow being essentially a landslide. And those things, when they occur on dry land, landslides don't necessarily go out. Well, there are some relationships that scientists have established in terms of the length of a landslide for a given height, those sorts of things. And these landslides have a very long runout distance. And so where do you think you see landslides like that? Well, you see them underwater on the seafloor, actually. So that's a second piece. A third piece would be that we see layered rocks on the floor. Those are sedimentary rocks. And then the mineralogical evidence is that in those layered rocks, we see clay minerals and we see carbonate minerals, both of which are the kinds of things you see in lake deposits on Earth or in the sea. You know, we talked about subsurface fluids before, subsurface water. And then here we're talking about a lake that would have been fed by groundwater. So that's interesting, because if you were to land a spacecraft in this deposit, in these set of deposits, you could investigate rocks and minerals that formed from water that came from the subsurface. And that is interesting, because if there's any chemical evidence for the habitability in the subsurface, this would be a great place to look for it. It could be that, you know, life originated in the subsurface on Earth. It could be that a good fraction of the life on Earth exists as microbes in the subsurface on Earth. So by analogy, we think it stands to reason that if there has ever been anything on Mars, it very well could have been simple life in the subsurface.
That's Dr. Joseph Michalski from the Natural History Museum in London and the Planetary Science Institute in Tucson, Arizona. NASA's Cassini spacecraft, which is studying the Saturnian system, may have detected pack ice on the surface of lakes and oceans on the moon Titan. Titan is the only known place in the solar system other than Earth to have lakes and rivers flowing on its surface. However, while the hydrological cycle means Earth's rivers and lakes and oceans are composed of liquid water, the freezing temperatures on Titan means its cycle involves the precipitation and evaporation of hydrocarbons like ethane and methane. The evidence comes from new Cassini radar data, showing a strange mix of reflectivity readings on the surface of some of Titan's lakes. Astronomers think the readings indicate there could be blocks of hydrocarbon ice flows floating on the surface. The formation of floating hydrocarbon ice will provide an opportunity for some interesting chemistry along the boundary between liquid and solid, a boundary which scientists think may have been important for the origin of life on terrestrial planets like Earth. Ethane and methane are organic molecules which scientists think can be the building blocks for the more complex chemistry from which life arose. Consequently, scientists believe one of the most intriguing questions about these lakes and seas on Titan is whether they too could host an exotic form of life. Cassini has seen a vast network of these hydrocarbon lakes cover Titan's northern hemisphere. A more sporadic set of lakes bejewels the southern hemisphere of Titan. Up to this point, Cassini scientists have always assumed that Titan's lakes would not have any floating ice. That's because solid methane is denser than liquid methane, and so would sink. But new models also include the interaction between the lakes and the atmosphere on Titan, resulting in different mixtures with changes in temperature. The result is that winter ice will float in Titan's methane and ethane-rich lakes and seas if the temperature is below the freezing point of methane, which is minus 183 degrees Celsius or 90.4 Kelvin. In fact, scientists realized that all varieties of ice they considered would float as long as their composition included at least 5% air, which is the average composition of young sea ice on Earth. Mind you, air on Titan has significantly more nitrogen in it than air on Earth, and almost no oxygen. However, if the temperature on Titan drops by just a few degrees, the ice will sink because of the relative proportions of nitrogen gas in the liquid versus solid state. Temperatures close to the freezing point of methane could lead to a mixture of both floating and sinking ice. In other words, a hydrocarbon ice crust above the liquid and blocks of hydrocarbon ice on the bottom of the lake bed. Scientists haven't yet entirely figured out exactly what colour the ice would be, although they suspect that it would be colourless just like on Earth, but perhaps tinted slightly reddish-brown from Titan's atmosphere. Scientists now think it's possible to get methane and ethane-rich ice freezing over on Titan in thin blocks that congeal together as it gets colder. Of course, that's exactly what we see here on Earth with things like Arctic sea ice at the onset of winter. Cassini's radar should be able to test this model by watching to see what exactly happens to the reflectivity of the surface of these lakes and seas. A hydrocarbon lake warming in the early spring thaw, as the northern lakes on Titan have begun to do, may become more reflective as ice rises to the surface. Now, in turn, this would provide a rougher surface quality, which reflects more radio energy back to Cassini, making the lake look brighter. Then, as the weather turns warmer and the ice melts, the lake's surface would become pure liquid, and so will appear to darken in Cassini's radar image. Cassini's extended stay in the Saturnian system is giving scientists an unprecedented opportunity to watch the effects of seasonal change on Titan and see if their theories are correct. That problem of losing satellite navigation signals could become a thing of the past thanks to new technology being developed to dramatically improve reliability. Curtin University's Professor Peter Chinisin and Dr. Denis Ogic have been developing a new method of combining signals from different satellite navigation systems in a single receiver. See, most civilian satellite navigation systems rely on the American military's Global Positioning Satellite System, GPS. It's the best-known system and is the only one with a fully operational constellation. SatNavs combining signals from GPS and Russia's GLONASS global positioning system are now already available. The new technology being developed at Curtin University will push this to the next generation, expanding it by integrating GPS with the new European Galileo and Chinese Bidao compass systems. The researchers say it'll also be capable of tracking new regional navigation systems being developed by India and Japan. More than 100 global navigation satellites will be operational by 2016, and 150 are expected to be in service by 2020, resulting in a broader and more diverse satellite navigation network. Australia's location places it in a rather unique SatNav hotspot, able to take advantage of both global and regional systems in the area, thereby improving accuracy and reliability. Satellite navigation systems require signals from at least 4 satellites for accurate coordinates. Often, however, SatNav receivers can't lock onto enough satellites, especially when signals are blocked by skyscraper-lined canyons in big cities or at the bottom of open mine pits. So integration of multiple satellite systems would improve reception by combining signals from several networks into a single system. The research, which is published in the Journals of Spatial Sciences and GPS Solutions, looked at ways of combining different signals.
This increase in satellites will give, if appropriately used, enormous benefits to various sorts of applications, because it allows you to improve accuracy in navigation, but also improved accuracy in other type of applications, improved integrity and improved availability, because of the increase in number of satellites. But all these advantages only can be realized if we are able to combine these satellites as if they were one system. So that means that if they are interoperable, and that's what we have been looking at, whether indeed one can consider these different satellites of these different systems in a combined and in a mixed way, such that they can be considered for the user as if they were just one single system.
Do they all work the same way?
The problem is that it's not easy to combine those systems because they have been developed differently. And if you combine them, you have to take care of all sorts of inter-system biases, inter-signal biases, all sorts of different hardware delays between the systems. And that could create a problem. For instance, currently, if you would be tracking GPS only, we know that the minimum number of satellites you need to track are 4 to get a position to solve for the 3 coordinates and for the receiver clock error. Now, if that rule applies to the case that you have GPS and Galileo, that would mean that you then could have 4 satellites consisting of 3 GPS, for instance, and 1 Galileo, or 2 GPS and 2 Galileo. So that would increase flexibility enormously. But that only works if the two systems are interoperable. So if that would not be the case, and if you have all these inter-system biases, for instance, if you would need an additional parameter to solve for in case of the 3 GPS, 1 Galileo system, then the 1 Galileo satellite is useless, because you need it to solve the extra parameter, and it would not allow you to solve for your coordinates. So that's the real issue when combining these systems, the interoperability between the systems, and that's what we looked at.
What's the methodology you're using to resolve that?
Well, the thing is that you really have to look at the original raw signals which are transmitted by the satellites. So it doesn't work if you start at the end of the whole data processing, because if you would look at the coordinates provided by GPS and the coordinates provided by Galileo, then you could, of course, in a way combine them. But that means that you would need all the satellites of both systems at the same time. So what we did, we went to the original signals transmitted and looked at those, developed models for describing those signals and seeing whether they could be combined at the original signal level. And indeed, we found that in case of combining GPS and Galileo, that these inter-system biases, unfortunately, are present. So they are not zero. So that's the bad news. But we also found with long-term tracking of these satellites, that these inter-system biases are, under certain circumstances and depending on the receivers you use, pretty constant in time. And that is the good news, because that means that we would be able to calibrate them. And if you're able to calibrate them, then at a certain time you know with sufficient accuracy their value, and then they can be assumed constant, and then indeed you can combine GPS and Galileo as if it was one system.
We're talking about regional systems, meaning what India, China and Japan are looking at developing, or in the case of China, of course, they've already got the birds up there. How are they different from the global systems being used by the United States, Russia and the Europeans?
Well, to give an example, the China system, COMPASS, is going through a number of phases, and it's now in its second phase. And the second phase is the build-up of a regional system. And that regional system consists then of 5 geostationary satellites, so satellites which stay stationary with respect to the rotating Earth, and inclined geosynchronous satellite orbits, which make a figure 8 in our region. Their ground tracks are stationary with respect to the Earth's surface. And the shape they are in are figure 8 shapes, and they pass over Perth, actually. That holds true for the Indian system, which is somewhat to the west of Australia, and it holds also true for the Japanese system, which is called QZSS, standing for a quasi-Zenit satellite system, and that is a regional system which is somewhat to the east of Australia. So we are nicely in the middle, and we can profit from all these satellites.
That's Professor Peter Tanissian from Perth's Curtin University. And that's the show for now. If you've missed part of it on the radio or you want to hear the show again, don't forget Star Stuff's available as a weekly podcast at abc.net.au/science/starstuff. The Star Stuff blog's always packed full of the latest news, spectacular images, stuff I find amusing, and heaps of other media we simply couldn't fit in the show. You can find it all at abcstarstuff.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase. And that's Tumblr without the E. And there's our ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest developments in astronomy, space sciences and cosmology as they happen. We give you current news, information, ongoing updates and cool URLs. Just Google in the at symbol followed by ABC Star Stuff, all as one word in lowercase, and we'll keep you informed. And for the latest news in science and technology, go to the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science.